Hello, I'm Simon Burton, and welcome to a midwinter edition of Arts Roundup, which finds artists in Cambridge exploiting the winter nights with light like never before. Auditions for film actors, takes a journey inside the human mind and creativity, and finds a new venue offering music on a Sunday evening. In this edition, we preview Twilight at the Museums with Cambridge University's Susan Miller. Alessandra Cajano promotes her forthcoming Illuminate Festival of Light. Filmmaker Axel Bangert appeals for young actors for a short film project that could be the start of a career. We look at how art can greatly improve the life of people with autism with chartered psychologist Beverly Stefford. And Afternoon Teas Cafe gets set to host live music sessions on Sundays in King Street. Finding something really interesting for the kids to do in cold, bleak, penniless February can seem a test of patience at times, but hey people, you're living in Cambridge. Twilight at the Museums is set to open on the 19th of February and will provide a nighttime torchlit bonanza of exciting adventure, exploration and discovery for kids in a dozen Cambridge University venues across the city, which attracted some 7,000 visitors on just one night last year. University of Cambridge Assistant Events Administrator Susan Miller previews the exciting goings-on that will leave kids completely spoilt for choice.
Susan, the Fitzwilliam is getting ready to present, seven museums all in all, a massive child-led event. Can you tell me what's happening?
The Fitzwilliam Museum is one of many venues, there's 12 in total, who are all participating in this year's Twilight at the Museums event, which is an evening of amazing exploration for families across museums and venues in Cambridge.
Now, you're doing it at night for a special reason, aren't you? Why is that?
Well, one of the reasons is it gives you a great opportunity to explore museums when they're normally closed to the public. And at this time of year, with it being a bit darker, it adds to the sort of drama and excitement of the occasion.
Now the theme is going to be light and dark, and children are going to be asked to bring their own torches, aren't they? Because it's all going to happen in torchlight.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, there's a bit of a mixture. It's light and dark, so some of the museums will have switched the lights out, and you will need your torch to help guide you through. Other museums have other events going on that will actually need to take place in light. Otherwise, it'd be a bit of a health and safety. So there's a bit of a mixture going on.
You're creating, obviously, an exciting environment of exploration, adventure, discovery, and also lighting up some of the exhibits. Which of the exhibits are you going to be lighting up?
Well, I believe that Sedgwick Museum are planning a light installation, which should be quite atmospheric given their dinosaurs and huge sort of Ice Age hippos that they've got. And the Museum of Classical Archaeology will have some of their fabulous plaster cast models all lit up as well.
Is this sort of connotations of Harry Potter, because it's using these massively wonderful establishment buildings at night with torches and lots of amazing things to see. It's a bit like Hogwarts, isn't it?
It is a bit. I think the idea is all about exploration and discovery. It's a way of connecting with museums and with the objects in museums in an exciting and different way, and allowing you to explore it using different senses.
Now, obviously playing around with light is going to be a big thing. You're going to be doing an enormous exterior projection, aren't you, onto the front of the museum?
Yes, we have a huge illuminated globe, which is going to be outside the Museum of Classical Archaeology. It's going to be full of kind of pulsating, changing images, and there is the opportunity for you to have your own image displayed across the globe.
Playing with light on Cambridge's buildings is becoming extremely popular now. We're running up to the second year of the Illuminate Light Festival. Is this something that the museums are really going to take up and start using the outsides of the buildings much more?
I think it's a really fantastic way of displaying what you have, the wealth of what you have, in a different way. We are partnering with Illuminate this year as part of the Illuminate Festival, and there'll be a cycle-powered cinema outside the Polar Museum, which should be fun.
Got lots of exhibits to have a look in. There are drop-in attractions at most of the museums. Can you give me a little bit of, in a nutshell, what's on at each one? The Fitz, first of all.
The Fitzwilliam Museum are having two theatre performances, which are bookable, and in addition to that, there'll be the opportunity to explore the museum galleries after hours. So there is a torchlit tour through the glass houses of the Botanic Gardens, and you'll be finding out about how plants are masters of trickery in disguise.
Any Triffids in there? Or?
Let's keep our fingers crossed. Or maybe some people would want to see the Triffids.
Triffids by torchlight, that sounds pretty exciting stuff. With all those huge leaves and things.
Lovely.
To get to grips with.
Classical archaeology have a torchlit tour through their galleries, and you're going to be seeing the statues come to life. And I think there's a bit of a competition for you to get involved with in the museum. Farmland Museum at Denny Abbey are going to be doing all sorts of activities related to darkness and light. Polar Museum got a fantastic film and the sounds and sights of ice. The Sedgwick Museum are going to be doing a mystery trail through their gallery, all in torchlight. The Science Centre, Cambridge Science Centre, have got all sorts of experiments to try out about perception and how your senses can trick your brain.
And then there's venturing into the solar system as well. It's another thing happening at the Whipple, isn't that right?
There is. So the Whipple aren't going to be focusing on the solar system this year. This year they're going to be exploring their models of bugs and natural science, which should be fun. The Museum of Technology have an amazing photography workshop, so they're inviting people to bring along their own camera and to make contrasting images of the fantastic collection that they have there.
Now, you're also running things like, how many kids are you expecting to turn out for this event, and how long is it going on for?
Well, how long's a piece of string? Last year we welcomed over 7,000 visitors, and this year we've got an extra hour, so we're open until 8:30, so we're hoping that little bit extra time, which will encourage more people to come and visit.
And you're doing events like Explorer Bingo, which is where you have to go and find something in the museum in the torchlight, which sounds incredibly exciting if you're small. And that will involve things like some 500-year-old potatoes. Where's that happening?
That's at the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. They have a fantastically diverse and eclectic collection, and it should be great fun trying to find some of their most unusual exhibits.
And those include grizzly bears, a Roman mouse. What's the Roman mouse? Where did that come from? You didn't know?
No,
don't worry about that. Okay. And then there's things like plant and rock samples, grizzly bears, all kinds of things, aren't there, to discover in the museum?
I think across the 12 venues, there are hundreds of thousands of exhibits in the collection. So there is an absolute wealth of diversity to find out about.
And gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and Rome are going to feature as well.
They will. That's the classical archaeology. We have a bit of everything in this city. It's quite amazing, actually. And we've also got some great bookable activities at Kettle's Yard, the Fitzwilliam Museum, as I've already mentioned, and the Museum of Cambridge. Great opportunity to try and visit more than one museum. A lot of people have their old favourites, but it's a great opportunity to try out something new for the night. So what I would do is to get the most out of your night, see how many places you can visit.
It sounds like an an opportunity for reinforcing school studies as well.
Absolutely, there's a lot of educational opportunities, but really it's about fun on the night.
Great stuff. Susan Miller, thank you very much indeed for telling Cambridge 105 about Twilight at the Museum. It sounds like a brilliant event coming up.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's not just children that are having endless fun with light shows next month either. As I found out from Alexandra Cajano, founder and organiser of the forthcoming Illuminate Festival of Light, local artists are doing it spectacularly too. Alessandra's core concept was to bring artistic Italian flair and sophistication with light shows from Turin's major landmarks to Cambridge by exploiting the architectural heritage in new ways with artistic light shows that also demonstrate the emerging light technologies Cambridge is spawning that might indeed help save the planet. She dropped into Cambridge 105 to preview the second Illuminate Festival of Light after she successfully persuaded technology firms, the City Council, and numerous sponsors to take it up seriously last year, demonstrating solar cars, glass energy-saving technology, and artwork with light effects on city centre buildings. The idea has taken hold and won funding, and is changing the midwinter skyline with light. And her Herculean effort as an outsider to bring the change upon us is really raising eyebrows. Following on from talking about children having amazing adventures in Cambridge's museums with torches and torchlit exhibits, the projection, which is going to be on the outside of the museum, was actually arranged by the Illuminate Festival of Light. And here with me is Alessandro Cajano, who is an organiser of that festival, which was launched last year and is about to have its second series running from the 12th of February. Alessandro, how are you?
Hi, very well. Thanks for the invite.
Last year's festival, how successful was the Illuminate Festival of Light? Because it aroused a huge amount of interest from people. Mm-hmm. And has it actually now grown in or evolved from what happened last year?
Very much so, Simon. Very much so. Last year we started really small. So we had over 5 days, six installations in the city centre. And we tried our best with the marketing effort. And in turnout, we got a really impressive people seeing the installations and talking about it. And this year has been fantastic. We've got many, many more partnerships. You just mentioned, obviously, Twilight at the Museum and the University of Cambridge Museums have been fantastic in supporting the project and helping us, you know, taking it forward for 2014.
It was originally your idea, wasn't it? Because using wonderful architecture with light shows and things is something that happens a lot in Italy. And you're from Turin. So basically, you suggested it, didn't you, in the first place, to partners on who are dealing with light technology on the Science Park and so on and so forth, to the City Council, to the University. And they picked it up for the first time last year. And you had some very interesting things there. You had a greenhouse with energy-generating glass. You had the World Eco Challenge solar car and one or two other exhibits. Can you tell me about what happened last year and what's going to be coming up in this year's festival?
Of course. So last year we had, as I said, six main installations. Yeah. And the idea of the festival, as you know, is to bring together, to connect the arts and technology, in particular looking at the sustainable side of technology and energy efficiency. Innovation. So two of the installations you mentioned were the polysolar greenhouse, which was an artwork put together by Susie Olczak and placed in the Senate House lawn, and it was absolutely stunning. And really the concept of the whole festival could be represented by the piece alone, because it really, the light coming from the sun activates, where it's collected rather, in the in this glass, is filtered by the glass and connected, and then released in the lighting installations that Susie put together. There was also another part of it which connected and lit up the beautiful tree that's just off the King's College Chapel. So it was a real complete cycle, if you want, of life, and it was really impressive.
Obviously, art with light being used to educate us about light and light technology. Absolutely wonderful thing. Now, the partners last year were people like Barclays,
Cambridge City Council. Was our main supporter. We also had a partnership with the Cambridge News. Taylor Vinter supported us. We had a number of
The technology
supporters.
Companies,
Yes.
Yeah. So who are the partners this year, and have you secured better funding and better projects for this year?
Better than last year is much bigger than last year. Yeah. These type of projects always do with more funding, as we all know. But the support this year has been amazing, and so many more partners have come on board. For example, I'd like to mention Mobus, who's doing our PR. Yeah. And I would like to mention our main technology sponsor, Panasonic, who've come on board and helped us with a number of installations and projections. So that's very exciting. But also local venues such as the Grand Arcade are going to host the launch event, the open ceremony, and John Lewis. That'd be absolutely fantastic. There are going to be so many things happening there. So watch this space.
So what are going to be the highlight attractions this time round?
It's really hard to say. There is so much going on. Yeah. The festival goes over 11 days, starts on the 12th of February, goes on until the 23rd. The key night, I would say, is the opening ceremony and the Grand Arcade.
And is there something special that's under wraps for that, or can you tell us what it's going to be?
I can't tell you. It would be a surprise otherwise.
I know that you personally, yourself, have put in a massive amount of work into bringing this Italian sophistication to Cambridge's streets. Although it wasn't a very big festival last year, it had a huge amount of interest and support. And this year it's going to be
bigger and more impressive. You're kind of hoping that this is going to become an integral part of the art scene in Cambridge, aren't you?
Yes, indeed. It will be great, and I think it will be immensely beneficial to us all, because the project really works across different sectors and different parts of the community, so we really want to integrate different parts of the city. And at the moment, due to obviously restricted resources, we can only concentrate in the city centre. But the vision ultimately is to have a city-wide event where each ward can really collaborate and create their own lighting installation.
In terms of the technology that's being employed, are there anything at the moment that you can actually buy as a gadget or enhancement for your home or for projecting things on the outside of your home if you wanted to do that? Is that something that you can do?
There's plenty of things, and this is part of the message behind the festival, is really trying to understand that this technology, it can be so stunning visually and can be very interactive in a number of things, but it can actually be the things that you use in your own home. And there are a number of places in the workshops and the talks during the festival where you can find out a little bit more information about it.
And obviously messing around with light is an endlessly fascinating occupation. All these children, last year 7,000 children took part in the Twilight at the Museums thing, and it's playing with torches, playing with lighting effects, a dash of the Harry Potter involved. But then when the grown-ups get involved with it, like you as well, using this technology, it becomes something that just becomes involves everybody in these incredibly striking ways. I mean, you did the outside of Great St Mary's Church last time. You've got the Fitzwilliam Museum with huge projections coming up there. Are there going to be other buildings that weren't featured last year that are going to be lit up?
There is going to be much more, yes. The programme has expanded. Again, we're talking about city centre, but yes, there are many more venues, and we'll release the programme shortly.
And in terms of technology companies, you had a good few involved last year. Have more come forward with different things that they're going to be showing?
Yes, indeed. It's been absolutely fantastic. The support of the technology sector and the industry has it's been great. There's so many more interesting SMEs come on board with innovative products, and that makes us feel really honoured to be able to be the platform for them to showcase this wonderful product.
How can people join in with the festival, Illuminate Festival of Light? How can they find out about it begin their education, as it were, into what you can do with light these days, basically?
Dusty, I would say the first step is to go onto the website. The website is www.e-luminatefestival.co.uk. Quite a long name, but just by putting e-luminatefestival should come up. And we'll have the full program in at the beginning of next week. We're also sending out newsletter this week, so there's plenty of information out there. We're going to release next week as well an app, which is very, very exciting. And we'll have a number of programs around the city centre in key places for people to pick up. It'll be great to see you all in the Grand Arcade for the 12th of February. It's going to be a memorable, absolutely spectacular evening.
Becoming a celebrated actor is pretty high on the wish list of many young people in the city, alongside winning the National Lottery or having the latest impressive duds and cyber lifestyle accessories. Well, if you really want to do it in celluloid, you have to start somewhere, and an opportunity is being offered to 105 listeners to audition for four parts in a short film about to be shot on Cambridge's streets. Filmmaker Axel Bangert, who's making a film called Frame, says it's a chance to see what it's like working as an artist with a professional film crew.
Axel, you're a local filmmaker in Cambridge. Tell me about yourself. How did you get into making films?
Well, I originally came to Cambridge to do a PhD on cinema. And in the course of that, I realized that cinema wasn't enough to write about film. I always wanted to also know what film is like from the inside. So with a couple of friends, teamed up, and we made a short film, which we shot in Long Stanton, just outside Cambridge. And ever since then, I guess I've been hooked.
What was that film about, and who are the people who you're doing the shooting with? The
first film was called Breaking Sugar. It was actually based on a short story by A.L. Kennedy. So it was not an original script of mine. The project I'm doing now, which is called Framed, is actually something I've written. And which I've written with Cambridge in mind.
Can you tell me a bit of a synopsis synopsis of the story? What's it about?
Sure. So the film is meant to be set in the Newmarket Road, Grafton Centre area, so maybe a part of Cambridge that one doesn't see that often, that much. And the film is about a young woman who works in a clothes store and who is mugged one night on her way home by two teenage boys. So they steal her money, and then later on when she has to walk home, because she doesn't have money for the bus, she catches one of the two boys, the little one, but he doesn't have her money, and she also notices that he has a small wound on his thigh. So she's asking herself if maybe the little boy was a victim of the older one, just like her. And then in the solution of the film, which I'm not sure if I should give it away now or not.
Don't give the solution away. So it's a short film. How long would it be, in fact?
Oh, I think it would not be longer than 10 minutes. That's I really try to keep it brief.
And you've come here today because, in fact, what you're looking for is some actors for the film. Can you tell me about the roles that they, who you need and what roles will they be fulfilling?
Yeah, so it's basically the three parts I was mentioning. So I'm looking to fill the part of the protagonist, a girl with a playing age of around 25, but there's some flexibility in that. And then the two teenage boys. So there I'm thinking of playing ages of 16 and 19 years respectively, although again there's some flexibility. If there's someone who is maybe 18 but looks slightly younger or can be made to look slightly younger, that's perfectly fine.
It's actually quite a big commitment, isn't it, taking a part in something like that, because it isn't a 5-minute thing. It takes a long time to set up film shots and script them and film them and editing. I mean, I can remember being on a film set and having to shoot the same about 1 minute of action about 15 times, and it took about 5 hours to do it. So it's not a simple thing to do, is it, sometimes?
No, it can be tough, but it's usually great fun if the team is good and if the team is nice and yeah, if it takes 15 takes, then, you know, everybody has to go through it.
And who are the film crew? Because they're going to get a chance to see how they work, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm talking to a couple of filmmakers I know in Cambridge, in the area, so I'm hoping to keep that quite local as well, although I haven't put everything into place yet.
And there's lots of young people in Cambridge who want to get involved in acting. It can be the beginning of a dream to get involved in a film. I can remember Rachel Weisz doing exactly this kind of thing when she was a student here in Cambridge in the streets. It can be a great beginning. It's a chance also, isn't it, to see how people work on a film set. I mean, how many films have you made in total so far?
4 or 5, one of which was a music video, so not really a narrative short film.
And what could this lead to, both for the actors and for you as a film group? Because in the past, we've talked to people making films in Cambridge in this way, Bloody Cuts being a group of filmmakers who make horror film shorts from King's Lynn, but they sometimes come to Cambridge to look for actors. If your film is a success, will you be looking for funding to go on to the next project?
That would be fantastic. I mean, I'd like to establish more working relationships also through this project. And if based on that, I could do another community project, that would be fantastic.
And what are the specific skills that people will learn if they manage to be picked as one of the people? Are you auditioning in a particular place?
Yeah, I think it will be a generally accessible kind of place where people can just pop by and then, you know, talk to us, get to know the team, and then maybe we rehearse a scene together. It will not be an audition where, I don't know, there will be very stern-looking people.
Do they need to have acting experience to do this, or can they be complete novices?
Not necessarily. No, I'm really interested in people who have some enthusiasm for the project and who'd like to find out about it, who are curious.
Okay, so if you're out there, you're young. There are 4 parts going, aren't there?
I have a small part, I didn't mention that yet, in the clothes shop that also works another girl, so the colleague of the protagonist. That would be another role to fill.
And you're looking for the age group between, you need a young boy, an older boy, the woman who's 25, and someone who works in the shop. So there's 4 parts, so an age group between 17 and 25, presumably.
Exactly.
And how can they get in touch with you?
Well, it's best to email me, I guess. My email address is ab534@cam.ac.uk. But I guess they could also always get in touch with you, and then you would link us up.
Yeah, we can do that. You can get in touch with Cambridge 105, to Simon at Cambridge 105 FM. And when will the film actually be screened? Is that going to be part of the film festival or something like that?
Well, if we get accepted. No, I'd love to do that, obviously. And I'd like to submit the film to various festivals once it's done. I'm hoping to finish it, I guess, in April. Post-production takes a bit of time, so I think that would be realistic. And one could have, you know, a private premiere with those involved and then show it in other venues.
I mean, in the post-production, presumably you have, you know, your storyboard and you know what's going to roughly happen in each of those locations. But once you've taken all your chunks of film, what happens in the post-production studio? I mean, is that a very complicated business, deciding what to include and what not to include and how to create, you know, splice it together to create the maximum effect? I mean, is that quite a team thing that happens?
I think it's good to do it at least in two, and with someone fresh, with someone from the outside who hasn't read the script and who just looks at the footage and helps you find out how the footage tells the story best, because that's not necessarily the way it's written down in the script. So in a way, you're building the film from scratch, and sometimes that can be a bit stressful, but it's also, there's also a bit of magic in that.
And where are you getting your resources from? The cameras, the equipment, studios and things like that, are those things that you have already as a group?
As a director, I actually don't own that much equipment, but many independent filmmakers, also professional filmmakers, have their own gear. And nowadays, with that kind of gear, one can actually make high-quality films.
Now, there are quite a lot of film groups in Cambridge. Obviously, there's those linked to both courses at the university, at Ruskin, at Hillsborough Sixth Form College, and then there are private groups as well. What's the community like of people who are actually making films on Cambridge's streets? I mean, do you all know each other? I mean, we spoke to the NERF Film Consortium a few weeks ago on one of their evenings where they were showing the films that they'd made around Cambridge. But what's the dynamic in Cambridge amongst people who are engaged in this kind of activity? Do you know lots of other groups and filmmakers?
I think there's a lot going on. There's the Trident Fest, which has done amazing films over the years. There's the Cambridge Filmmakers. Which meet up now and then and do projects together. I think, it's a really vibrant scene and people tend to know each other and, you know, know what kinds of projects are going on. And, you know, I'm hoping to include some of the people I know through these channels also in the shoot.
It's a great opportunity here to get involved in local filmmaking. Axel, thank you very much indeed for telling 105 about it.
Thanks to you. And, I'm really looking forward to anyone who might be interested in taking part.
Many of us are fascinated by the mystery of where creativity arises from in the human brain and psyche, and it's been the subject of many scientific studies. The aesthetics of appreciating art in the mind are different for each and every one of us and determine our artistic preferences. It's been shown that people who lose frontal lobe activity in the brain, albeit just temporarily, can later develop better artistic skills. It's an area that scientists and doctors examine closely in people with common disorders, which give intriguing neurological clues when the subject experiences or participates in different types of art. Dr. Beverly Stefford is a chartered psychologist and expert on neuroaesthetics and has written on the neurology of art. She works with children with attention deficit syndrome, dyslexia, dyspraxia and autism. Here she talks about her work.
Beverly, give us a quick introduction to neuroaesthetics.
This was the subject of a series of Reith lectures by Ramachandran some years ago. It's the brain's ability to recognise, in the visual arts at least, shape and form and colour, illumination and movement. And we all have parts of the visual cortex devoted to a particular thing. We don't see everything as a whole. We first of all see the shape, the outline, then we notice the texture and so forth, whether it moves and so forth. And so once we have a part of the brain that might emphasise, let's say, form over colour, then you would like the type of art, for instance, Mondrian, who looks at form rather than colour. Or if your part of the brain that you emphasise over the, throughout the visual cortex is more enhanced in the colour area, then, of course, you like the impressionists and so forth. So the idea is different parts of the brain emphasise different aspects of the world, and if that part of the world is an art that emphasises form, like Mondrian, or colour, like the Impressionists, and so forth, then you'll prefer that type of art. And if you're an artist, you'll prefer that sort of art. Basically, that's what neuroaesthetics is. Once you prefer a certain form, colour or whatever, it gives you pleasure to look at it. And then that's how that's linked to the brain's dopamine systems, reward systems. It's a neurochemical. And Ramachandran says this comes from a basic biological propensity to like things that are good for us. And he gives a wonderful example of herring gold checks. Now, many years ago, Tim Bergen, a neurologist, no, ethologist, found that baby checks like to peck at their mother's beak. There's a red spot on the mother's beak, which would stimulate the chick to open their beak and regurgitate the food for the babies. Fine. That's natural. That's what's called a fixed action pattern, and that's how the chicks get their food. But Tim Bergen would get bits of red dots for paper, cardboard, or and various things, and find that the chicks would peck at those too. So they didn't know the difference between the real mother. All they had was a stimuli inside their brain that said, peck at red dots, especially if they're on yellow things, strips. So he imagined that if these herring gold chicks ever had an art gallery, what they would put in it would be pictures of long models of long yellow beak-like things and lots of red spots. So that's okay. That is the idea of neuroaesthetics. We have a frisson in the brain when we see something that stimulates our reward systems, the dopamine hit. And that's the whole idea of how different types of art are liked by different types of brain organisation.
And obviously that fuels your study of people with these conditions and what's actually happening.
Yes, I have linked that to learning styles and learning preferences, okay. Yes. It seems quite obvious to me.
Last time we talked about dyslexia and art, and today we're here to talk about autism. I've just been looking at a very interesting website called Create Art for Autism, looking at some of the fantastic... It's a national competition campaign which was launched last year to prove... that art significantly improves the quality of life for autistic people.
Well, and also it does for anyone, doesn't it?
It's for anyone, but particularly helps facilitate experimental-based learning and instills lifelong skills. So there's a very strong link between the benefits of art and treating autism, isn't
there? Yes, I think a very good example would be the famous autistic artist, Patrick.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of him?
No, I haven't.
He could glance at a building just a few seconds and do a detailed representation right down the last window catch, just a few seconds. Of course, there was some early criticism. It's just like a photograph. It's not really art and that sort of thing. But as he went on to do that, he developed more symbolic associations with buildings. And of course, that went with his general improved cognitive capacity.
There are lots of things. I mean, obviously, we talked last time about dyslexics and how dyslexics can actually have an advantage in the spatial learning part of their brain, which can translate into producing better artwork for things like design and
different types of artwork, multidimensional things. They can pick up patterns, so they tend to be good at sculpture and the multidimensional sort of pictures where space and shape is important.
And with people with autism, dealing in minute detail seems to be something that they can do very well.
Absolutely.
What exactly is autism?
It's defined as a social communication disorder. And, of course, there are degrees. So the general high-functioning autistic, usually described as Asperger's, they're fine. They go to school, they do anything like anyone else, with the exception they don't generally have friends. They don't have the give and take of conversation. They're quite naive children. Their thinking and their communication is a little bit black and white, so they miss all the subtleties. And you see that in the art. They go for detail. They have all the raw sensory data that comes in through the brain, they get hung up on. And can produce very detailed pictures. And sometimes, certainly in forensic art and that sort of thing, I can imagine they would be much better than anybody else. But you can't compare that type of art with, let's say, the more broader sweep of the dyslexic child, or the colour and the sort of impressionist type of painting that ADHD children tend to light more. So that was the original point.
Is the neurology of the brain of someone who has autism different in the same way that it is in dyslexia from a normal brain? So they have, it's not, that they actually see patterns, colours and shapes differently
from
a normal person.
Well, they over-perceive. The raw sensory data come in, stays in their perception and doesn't move forward to the cortex to be interpreted in the way that a normal person, well, let's say a neurotypical person would, whereas the dyslexic, on the other hand, tends to have more long-range connections between all areas of the brain, so can bring in experience, memory, thoughts, theories, and so forth, to have a much more subtle, symbolic, abstract type of art. Or even thinking.
Is it about the way that you actually use the visual cortex in your mind? Because obviously dyslexics have a problem with language, and so they use the visual cortex in order to plug the meaning gap.
Big debate about this. Because your linguistic ability is mostly left hemisphere mediated, less active, does that mean your leading edge is how you visualise things? That may be the case. It may be that genetics have meant that they're much better at that in the first place anyway, develop right hemisphere skills. You know, the jury's still out on that. Actually, the jury's still out on all these learning difficulties. Are they just things that are maturational lags that can be overcome with experience, but because it's a bit difficult for this type of thing rather than that type of thing, they don't have this experience they need? I don't know. Now, I think autism is really quite a different case. Really autistic, severely autistic children are very damaged. They certainly couldn't go to mainstream school. They spend their days looking at detail, sort of like spinning wheels and so forth, things that have no productive purpose, whereas the more higher functioning autistic child or person will use that same type of ability to see detail in a better way.
Talking about the fabulous, I mean, for the Create Art for Autism website, there are something like 812 entries of artwork by people with autism from last year's competition.
Yes, they had a wonderful
and if you
one.
Have a look through those paintings, they are, some of them are absolutely superb. And they're everything from portraits to drawings to landscapes to
abstracts. How many portraits would you judge?
There were a good
Faces.
Good fair few. Yeah. And they had obviously experimented with art that they'd been looking at, whether these were sort of things that were drawn from Picasso or so on and so forth. They tried to employ those in the images on their faces. Yeah. So and you're looking at this wonderfully colourful work, this wonderfully varied work, and also of a very high standard as well. And it's amazing actually that the ability that they displayed was quite remarkable.
I can imagine that's very therapeutic. And why I ask you about portraits, because the one thing I wouldn't imagine an autistic artist to be able to do well would be faces. It seems in brain imaging studies, the part of the brain that recognises faces is not active so much.
And art involves multiple interpretations, and obviously there's really no rules as to how you see the world if you're going to put it into a piece of art. And being able to express yourself with that must be quite important, especially if you're a person who has a lot of difficulty in interacting with other human beings. It's like another language, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Someone with autism.
Yes.
If people wanted to take some advice from you on this kind of thing, can they get in touch with you?
Yes, of course. My website's learningrecovery.go.uk. And then I mentioned doing quantum brain maps. That's www.qeeg.co.uk.
Dr. Beverly Steffert, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to Cambridge 105. And we will do a sequel to this on attention deficit syndrome at some point in the future.
And the whole concept of neuroaesthetics.
You may have noticed a fair few pubs, cafes and eateries popping up to venture something new in the city just recently. Among them, posited next to the art supplies shop in King Street, is Afternoon Teas, a stylish modern cafe that's now offering live music in a bid to end dull and uneventful Sunday evenings with some good cheer. Owner Joe Kraskinska, a former freelance illustrator, says come and enjoy some company and atmosphere.
We offer breakfast every day, and then every lunchtime we offer three different sandwiches, soup options, which we hand make here on site, and then cakes, obviously lots of cakes.
Who are your sort of target customers? Who do you think this will appeal to particularly?
I don't know if we particularly have a type of customer. We have a very broad range. I think we noticed over Christmas when our students went home, but then we were still full with another group of people. So it's really, really lovely to see the wide range of our regulars.
It's great to see a variety of new ideas coming to Cambridge's streets, but you're actually going to be offering live music quite soon, aren't you?
Yeah, we've already done our first Sunday session. Actually more than just a music night. There's a lot of new music nights happening around Cambridge, especially like Hot Numbers are really leading the way with that, which is really exciting. What I wanted to do with the Sunday session is kill the Sunday night blues. I used to get them really badly when I worked in an office. I hate Sunday nights. You've already written off your weekend. You're having a sulk about having to go back to work. And the idea is to bridge that Sunday night gap between 5 and 9, with offering some live music, good atmosphere, a few beers and friends, and kind of just make more of an event of Sunday, really. I think with the walls of afternoon teas, it's actually, I've had a lot of people approach me to put stuff up, and I'm already struggling to see whether I should or whether I should leave some space, because it's quite cosy, and by putting a lot of stuff on the wall, it might.
Well, you're right next to the biggest art store in the region, aren't you?
Yeah, it's great.
So there must be lots of artists who probably want to drop in here.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of art students come in as well. Yeah.
Who is coming up next to the music agenda?
So on the 2nd of February, we haven't actually put it out there yet. So this is breaking news it's Will Robert. Mm-hmm. Very, very talented Cambridge musician. Yeah. You may have seen him busking. He busks on King's Parade quite a lot. Yeah. He's amazing. Yeah, so I'm really, really looking forward to having him here on the 2nd.
And will you? How often will you be having musicians in?
We're aiming for once a month to do the Sunday session, and then we'll be offering some food and wine and beer, and Will will be playing. But just really encouraging people to drop in and drop out between 5 and 9.
It's time to take a look at a pick of what's coming up in the city in the next few weeks. But if you're listening to the rerun of the programme, some of this may be out of date. Marlowe's classic Dr. Faustus, a story of a man who makes a pact with the devil for occult knowledge, opens at the Arts Theatre on January the 29th. On February the 14th, Kettle's Yard Gallery opens Art and Life in 1920-1921, featuring work by Ben Nicholson, Wilfred Nicholson, Christopher Wood, Alfred Wallace and William State Murray. Wising Arts Centre in Bourne celebrates its 25th anniversary with a group exhibition, Annals of the 29th Century, which kicks off on the 16th of February and runs till the end of March. It features a combination of newly commissioned work from 2013 and also takes the writing of Gustav Metzger as a starting point and steals its name from the novel of science fiction writer Andrew Blair. Agatha Christie's Black Coffee opens at the Arts Theatre on January the 20th, and promises Murder Most Foul of eccentric inventor Sir Claude Amory at a country house, and actor Robert Powell as Hercule Poirot investigates. Coming up at the Junction on January the 31st, Hal Cruttendon of Have I Got News For You fame does his stand-up comic show. Make sure to buy tickets early, he's often the sellout. The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra presents an evening of 1920s music at the Corn Exchange on January the 30th, Conductor David Charles Abel leads an orchestra playing Gershwin, Copland and Bernstein classics, joined by virtuoso pianist Freddie Kempf. On Wednesday the 26th of February, West Road Concert Hall hosts Tognetti Directs, Vivaldi, Bach and the World's Finest Orchestra, featuring a pre-concert talk with violinist Richard Tognetti of the Australian Chamber Orchestra. And that brings us to the end of this programme, and I hope you've enjoyed listening in to the Art Dimension with Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.